I have 9 o'clock. We will call this meeting to order. And if I may, call upon our secretary, Regent Thomas, would you be kind enough to call the roll?
I will. Regent Bell?
Present.
Regent Roddy?
Present.
Regent Dennison?
Present.
Regent Hammonds?
Present.
Regent Hume?
Here.
Chair Milliken?
Here.
Regent Nichols?
Present.
Regent Spiller?
Present.
Secretary Thomas? Here. Vice Chair West?
Present.
And Regent Curtis?
Here.
All right, we have 11 regents present representing the board.
I was thinking we had a complete cohort this morning. So we're happy to have everybody here. And Regent Hammonds, we're glad to have you here by Zoom. I don't see you there, but I'm told you're there. I heard your voice a little bit earlier.
I'm here.
Very good. Very good. The first item on the agenda this morning is an executive closed session. Regent Brody, do you have a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the board go into closed session as provided in KRS 61.810, subparagraph 1 for the following discussion. Discussion of a proposed or pending litigation against or on behalf of the university.
Second. Have a motion. Second. All in favor say aye. Any opposed say no. Motion carries. For the record, the board has now returned to open session. The discussions and deliberation during the closed session were restricted to those stated in the motion. No formal action was taken by the board in closed session. So I'll declare the committee meeting now in session. And let me give you all a reminder. And I was reminded of this morning, and as I need to be reminded of things on a regular basis. Only committee members can make motions during a specific committee meeting. And only committee members can vote on matters within those committees. I tend to forget that sometimes myself. I get kind of involved in what's going on. So that's why I remind myself as well as all the rest of you about that. That being said, Chairman Regent Bell, you have the Academic and Affairs Committee, sir.
All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we will resume our meeting in a more normal fashion. We have Provost Fisher with us here, and I have all my committee members as they're listed in the room with us. So, Provost Fisher, we have several action items to talk about today.
Yep.
Present.
I guess we'll start with the first three, then we'll present that have to do with academics. I think what you'll see from what we are asking for approval for is new and modern programs that fit where we are as a society and what we do. And what you will also see is that I think it's interdisciplinary. And as we talked before, as a group in here, interdisciplinary is an important matter as we move into the future. The first one will be to look at the approval of Bachelor of Science in User Experience. And Dr. Arnold is here, and I'd love for her to tell you about it.
Hey, can we just stand here? I need to be in any kind of... Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for allowing me to take a minute or two today to introduce the User Experience Bachelor of Science degree. My name is Christina Arnold. I'm Chair of Art and Design, and we are one of the partners that is bringing this interdisciplinary program to you. I wanted to take... You have the proposal in front of you, so I don't want to reread that, but take kind of the high points, which will be what, why here, and why do we think this will work? So first, what? What is it that this program is designed to do? And that is to train or to work with students to help them learn how to design digital products. Digital products, web design, so you're very familiar, web applications, the applications on your phone, wearable tech you have on your wrist, any kind of interface with systems. So you go to the doctor and they log all your health information, and then you go back home and you look up the results. So all of those things are digital products. Why? The employment stats tell the first part of the story, and that's jobs in UX are destined to go up 13% higher than the average growth rate of other industry. We think that only tells part of the story, because the other thing is with the growth of e-commerce and all kinds of traditional brick and mortar stores going online, with the growth in digital platforms, every company essentially becomes some sort of a digital company. So everything is a tech application at this point, and you need somebody. If you don't have the money to spend on someone to be a UX designer on your force, think Macy's, think Apple, then if you're a mom and pop, you're going to need somebody who understands these skills. How do I get my information out to an audience over the web? Do I have an app on my phone that I can download to buy your stuff? You all know by going online who has good interaction and who has poor user interaction. Why here? Simply, no one else has done it yet. This would be the first program in the Commonwealth, and that's exciting. It's growing. There's about 150 programs globally, 50 of those in the United States. So again, academia is lagging behind the need, and we want to be at the forefront of that. Second, our students are interested, our students on this campus, and we know that because we ask them. We did a survey for the feeder programs, computer science, art and design, UX, and 84% of the students asked, said, yes, if there was this bachelor's science degree on this campus, I would be interested. Why do we think this will work? We're kind of already doing it. So this comes out of a relationship. The interdisciplinary is important, but interdisciplinary is hard. And so computer science and art and design have now a five-year relationship. I think I was here almost 5 years ago in front of this same board arguing for our joint certificate in game design. And so that's now been online for, or it's existed for 3 years. We have 50 students in it. That is a joint program between CS, art, and design. So we've got that relationship. And you all may be familiar with the app SunSketcher, or Dr. Emsley's project that he's been leading. The team behind that is our team. So that's our faculty, that is our students, and those are the folks that have built that app. And again, it is design, it's development, it is research, and it is application and its evaluation, and then you go up to redesign. So that's what we're talking about here. In short, it's efficient. We have the faculty and the students here. We have the team. We have proof of concept, SunSketcher. We've done it. We essentially have all the blocks here. We're just stacking them differently. Thanks. And I can take questions if you have them.
So, Dr. Arnold, thank you for coming. Quick question is I've had students who work in this area, working in the art side, and also coming to the college. This is just talking with them about this. This is one of those areas that AI is creeping into. A student that goes through our program, what are they going to be able to add? Oh, we're just using AI to do this kind of work for you.
That's an excellent question. And I mean, we're fooling ourselves if we say AI is not creeping into our area. It's everywhere. And another term for user experience is human-computer interaction. And that's a team, and AI might be half of that team, the computer, but it is not human. And coming from art and design, I can tell you, like, we've had a love affair with the computer as a tool for a long time. So the camera killed painting, right? But we still paint. The internet killed everything else, but we still have, you know, digital killed film, but we still have photography. Like, these things are still important. And the human touch is something that we love. Otherwise, it makes it inhuman. So that's from a self-interested argument. I love things that look like they were created by a person. I love things that are different, and I think we all do. Whether you love cars or fashion or shoes or, you know, hats or phones or paintings, like, we all want something that looks different, and that is the human part of design. But when you're talking about human-computer interaction, this is how human beings handle technology. And so you can build technology, but if you can't use it well, and again, SunSketcher, I think, is a good proof of concept, and I love the computer science students and faculty. The beta version they gave us, like, here's SunSketcher, and we looked at it and we're like, dude, this looks like it was designed on the DOS prompt. Like, there were no instructions, there were no pictures, there was nothing that talked me through this. And so we gave it to the UX students, and they built animation, and they built illustrations, and they built a set of instructions, you know, so you pick it up, and it tells you, like, how to angle your phone correctly and how to set it. It's not in, like, C sharp line type on the screen. So that we need both sides to make it work. The designers, you give them an app assignment and they give you a great prototype, but there's nothing behind it. Like, it looks great, but it doesn't store your data, it doesn't sift your data, it doesn't have any kind of, you know, robust piece in the cloud in Northern Virginia somewhere.
So I note in the description you talk about a cost-effective launch because we're using existing faculty. Yeah. How many students? What's the projections on size of this program?
That's a great question. And I think we can look at kind of the parallel, the certificates we've developed, game, graphic design, because we're starting with a latent audience first. We're looking at people who are already here. Game, in 3 years, went from 0 to 50. Graphic design went from 0 to 75. And those are kind of the feeder programs. Computer science itself has over 200 majors. So, and we asked, you know, this crew of people. So I think we had just over 60 people respond. 84% said, yes, I want this program. That's over 50 students who are on our campus now.
I have a kind of a wonky question. So you're collaborating across silos, right? And so the concern with RCM and our budget model was that it would disincentivize that kind of collaboration. But this is not the only place you've collaborated. You've also worked on with some investment on research, including engineering as well. And talk to me about kind of how this all plays out within that budget model conversation and how does the money get work.
No, that's excellent. And Tuesday, is she in the room? Tuesday Helbig has played a part in helping us too. So so this also comes out of the XR Lab, which is a partnership between art and design and School of Engineering and Applied Sciences. It comes out of the game design certificate, which is poised to grow and revise. And partly, you have unlike people you think in the room together, because it's like, well, what are the art designers hanging out with the computer scientists? And I thought our students were shy, and then I met the computer science students. but you put them in a room together, and they are making magic, literally. And whenever I say magic, it's really like coding or chemistry. But I think the money piece I think about too, because I'm a chair. And as designers, we figure out how to make a system work. And I just get to the auditor. So I'm like, no, my new best friend. We had to do a couple things a little bit differently. So we now co-own the program, and we hardwired that.
Yep.
We co-own the numbers in terms of maker, and we co-own student credit hour production. My big drum I keep beating, if I'm not sure if this happens yet, is student credit hour production should follow the faculty, which I think happens sometimes, but not all the time, but that would help because there, even though we're altruistic, there has to be some self-interest baked in, or we won't do it.
And I will say just really proud of the creativity that you all have shown, number one. Number two, what a great example of the investment of our trans-institutional investment fund. That really worked to help kickstart the XR Lab, which has gone on to continue great things. So, congratulations.
Thanks, and also the Home to SunSketcher. And again, I am standing here as a representative of the people who are the architects of this program,
right,
who are UX faculty in art and design, CS faculty, engineering, and then, Emsley over at...
So kudos to you, or everyone involved. I mean, it's a great program.
Thanks.
Any other questions, comments? I appreciate your comment on human touch, and as AI is invading all of our lives more and more daily, I go back to the book we talked about last summer, Why We Remember and What Neuroscience is Teaching Us, and that is that AI does not bring context and nuance to our world and our conversations, and that's important. We do need painters. The human touch more and more, I think.
Yes, and as a physician, you know that, I'm sure. Yeah, and we need it to set the agenda. I think the other fear is who drives who. And so we want to make sure as humans that we're the people who are the first part of the process and not that neuroscience and AI and our apps are training us. So that's another important piece, actually, is we have a new ethics-based course that is being taught the first time this spring. And it is future design, essentially all of the questions about why we design, who we design for, how do we make design universal and apply to everyone, and how do we make sure it's the human being that's setting the agenda and not us absorbing what someone else has run through an algorithm and is giving us.
Yes.
We don't want TikTok teaching us everything, you know?
We can only hope. Comments, questions? We need approval of this today.
This afternoon.
Committee first.
Committee first.
Motion. Yeah. We have our five members present. I have a motion from Regent Nichols. And do I hear a second?
Second.
Regent Helm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your time. Stay tuned. Watch this space.
The second approval we're looking for is approval of an undergrad certificate in business fundamentals offered through the Gordon Ford College of Business. Dean Thrasher is here.
Good morning. Thank you for being here this morning. Yes.
Valentine's.
Yes. This is a day when I use that opportunity to thank our staff and our college for what they do and just show a little love to them because they're loving on us every other day of the year. So this certificate actually has come out of a variety of requests and a variety of conversations, beginning with majors outside the College of Business who now recognize that their students really do need some business knowledge as they move into perhaps entrepreneurial pursuits, the workplace, that sort of thing. We've had a business administration minor for many years. And it's a large minor. It's 30 credit hours. That's at least two semesters of additional coursework for the students who choose that minor. What we've seen is over the years, the demand for those minors has shrunk. So there's been decline in enrollment in the minor. There's been decline in demand for the minor. But what we're hearing from employers is that certificates carry a lot of weight with them. It shows that a student has added an additional area of focus to their academic credentials. They have a very focused set of knowledge that makes them a great entry-level employee or prepares them, if they're going into their own business, to hire the right people, even. So that's how this certificate came to be. We shrunk. The minor is still in existence for the time being, but we'll continue to follow it, and it may be completely replaced by the certificate at some point. The certificate's only 21 hours. At least 2 to 3 of those courses if the student plans ahead can be completed as part of their colonnade, which shrinks the number of hours even further. But we feel like that will be a great... Every student at Western has a set of general electives. And when we can package those electives into a second credential, we just send them into the workforce even more prepared and more skilled. And so that's where this has come from.
So I have a couple of questions. First, just to clarify, when you say the enrollment in the minor is going down, your college enrollment is going up, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, it is.
So are these classes that are on these lists, they're pretty well full right now, aren't they? The accounting, the econ, the management, the marketing, the basic fundamentals courses.
They're full every semester. They're full every year. We have a wonderful set of part-time instructors who help us pick up the additional load for those courses. And particularly those that are part of the colonnade, we have an obligation to the university to ensure that there's capacity in those courses. So to your point, yes, they are popular courses. They always have been, and they will continue to be. But there are, generally speaking, across those sections, a few empty seats in each section.
Okay. So kind of like the same question with Dr. Arnold, what kind of students do we think on projections that this will reach out to over a few years as it grows?
Yeah. I would imagine, so currently the minor has about 140 students in it, right, across the university. I would envision that over time, and in exchange for the minor, that 140 will shift to certificate. But that will be over a period of time, obviously. If enrollment grows through the programs who've reached out to us from other colleges, then clearly we'll have to look at hiring personnel to address those demands, but that will be a really great problem to have.
So in full disclosure, I'm one of the people who teaches one of these very full courses, so in case you're wondering like why I'm asking some of these questions. So if we have that kind of growth, we have enrollment growth, do you feel supported that we'll be able to get those lines in this area?
Oh, 110%. We're already hiring two new instructors now that will fulfill a management demand and a combination of management and marketing demand. And those folks will start in the fall semester. So, yeah, we have the support from everybody at this end of the table to provide those resources when they're needed.
Do we have the room?
Room.
And the new board of fourth office business?
Yes. Okay. I'm like, but yes. So we've already done our class scheduling for fall in the new building, and we're still only at about 75% capacity in that building, and that is not using extensively the 8 a.m. slot, that is not using the evening slot. So yes, that building was designed for growth.
Dean Thrasher, there was some rumor going around that there were only 11 classrooms in the new College of Business building, as I understand it. We certainly have more than 11 classrooms in that building.
Yes, we have 21.
Ah.
Yes, we certainly do. And we continue to offer about 30% of our courses, both face-to-face and online. We don't have any, other than graduate programs, we don't have anything that's online only. But we do offer, particularly in some of our programs, the combination of online and face-to-face so that students who are trying to double major can take it online when the face-to-face conflicts with their other courses as well.
So I just wanted to, Dean Thrasher and I, obviously we go way back, and this is my area, so I am supportive of this. I'm not trying to undermine any particular thing here. Just one of the things that I have to bring to the board is the faculty perspective and the recognizing the tensions that we have as we continue to increase class sizes and streamline, as we've had to do with the budget pressures that we talked about. And just to give an example, and it's not a course that's on this list, you know, Regent Kurtz is in my class right now, and sad to say for him, it's a class that's 40% larger than what it has been in the past. I have many more students in there, and I can't deliver the same amount of engagement and help to those students as I've done in the past. And I want to, you know, as I'm asking these questions about what kind of growth do we see, will it be supported of any of these, I think we need to continue to ask this because we focus so much on the financial side. And where we're alleviating a lot of those pressures is by growing class sizes, by trying to get streamlined on that. And there's a potential at some point of reaching a point where we're no longer doing what we say we're doing. Makes us different, that we, the faculty, do know their students' names. And so I'm fully in support of this. I just want to continue to try to make sure we're aware we're pushing up to that line of not doing what we say we are and not being able to meet those demands that we're creating. So I would hope to see at some point we back off on some things we don't, that aren't part of what we're doing, like minor or other things.
Well, and the other thing I would add to that, though, too, is the certificate alone won't grow the university's enrollment. Mm-hmm. What the certificates do is allow those students who are coming here or who are on the fence about coming here to see that there are ways to make really great use of their electives, their general electives, their extra requirements. If they are going to be finished in 3.5 years, they can stay 4 years and complete some additional credentials. So a lot of that increase, too, is a shuffling that students who maybe would have filled the rest of their schedule with general electives will now choose to add a business certificate instead. That puts out a lot more qualified product and a lot more qualified graduate for the workforce. And when we're doing that, then the resources will follow to ensure that we have the faculty to support those types of programs, because our corporate partners will step forward and say, you are producing exactly what we need. Let us help you continue to do that.
So it's worth noting that some of those corporate citizens are offering these themselves as they inch into higher education. Microsoft and Google have courses that offer certificates. So I'd much rather have us doing that.
Yes, I agree completely.
So,
do you have any questions? I'm going to add something. Regent Bell.
Sure.
One of the things I was going to add is that from like the student, like LinkedIn, like point of view, like this is such an excellent idea, because being from any other discipline besides, you know, strictly going forward and all that entails, and being able to say that you have business fundamentals thing, like I can already see, like I can imagine the LinkedIn reactions in my head. Like that is a very great idea, and it will benefit the students in it. But kind of like to Shane's point, one thing I have noticed from the progression of me coming in 2021, when we were still had so many students online, like obviously in 2022 with more people getting back on campus coming out of the line, like the class sizes are going to get bigger, and everybody was expecting that and bracing for that. But even from 2022 to 2025, the classes have gotten, every class that I've had has gotten bigger and bigger every single year. And I think that a huge selling point that Western really differentiates itself in the Commonwealth is that you can get the same quality of education that you would get at other places down the road, but you can get to know your professor better, and you can get to really build those connections with your faculty that can set you up for success, but also allow you to not have fear that a lot of students have to be able to ask questions, get to know faculty, like, you know, have a mentor in those sort of ways. And so I'm glad to hear that if, you know, this is something that a lot of other disciplines on campus have people supporting it within their minor or stuff like that, that will be able to support it. And that was my big concern, because I would hate for us to lose sort of the foundation that we build our selling point across. Because I even have friends that work in like Top Guide and stuff like that. And the selling point of small class sizes where you get to know your faculty while also receiving a world-class education is what makes Western so great. And if we're just, you know, trying to get more people in Gordon Ford, but losing that, I think that kind of, you're kind of losing the plot. So I hope that when we move forward with this, we'll be able to support it, that we can still have the smaller class size, because I feel like that's what makes Western so great.
Yeah, 100% agree. And my data analytics background has led me to do a whole lot of analysis on those types of concerns. And currently, now, there are some outliers. There are some courses that are larger than we would like them to be, because we have had faculty who retired in December. We allow people to take semesters. We have, you know, female faculty who take maternity leave and those sorts of things. But over the past 5 years, our upper division courses are still averaging 30 in a class size. Our lower division classes are averaging 35 to 38 in a class size, even with the growth. Now, what that means is there are some faculty who feel that growth more. Part of that is also because we're seeing shifts in where students are choosing to major. Mm-hmm. And we can't always predict that.
That's very true.
We can't predict who will come in as a finance major versus a management major. And further than that, we can't predict who will come in as a finance major. But the analytics shows that overall, we are maintaining the class sizes that we feel are appropriate for our students, and that our accrediting body feels are appropriate for our students. And that's why and that analytics also allows me now to start prioritizing our hiring, so that the folks like Dr. Spiller and others who are feeling the effects of those retirements and other things can have some room.
And I would add to that if you look over the university, that's what's happening across all the colleges as we speak. If you look over the last 5 to 7 years, there really hasn't been a huge change. Most of them are under 30 went for each of the colleges. So we're still teaching upper division classes with less than 30 kids in them as we speak. And we're watching those numbers and constantly thinking about the trade-off, as you said, Shane, how many people you have versus the type of education you are. And we're nowhere near our peer groups in a large education. So that's part of what we think. We look at the analytics all the time. I shared it actually at the last dean's meeting, and it came from Evelyn, who had done some work, and we shared it across the whole group of us to make sure where we were and to understand how it's changed. And we're talking about minimal change when we look at the means.
Yeah,
That's kind of the point, though. We're not supposed to be with our peer groups in this area. We're supposed to be a standout leader that Western, the experience that you get at Western is so substantially greater than anything that we're comparison to. Like, I kind of get caught up in the whole, like, comparing us to our target institutions because we should be, like, the shining light on the hill.
We are.
And I believe we are. And I just want to make sure to clarify that we can continue to do that because I think that in comparison, when you're a student that's looking for somewhere in our cost range, our student body range, the facilities that we offer, and you can still have that class size, you know, ratio, I guess you could say, like, I think that we should just be blown out of the water.
What is the average, Provost Fisher, what is the average class size of our peer institutions?
Somewhere between 30 and 40.
Great. And ours is under 30, and it hasn't changed in the past 5 to 7 years?
No.
I appreciate you're feeling it.
Mm-hmm.
N equals one is not generalizable. So we're working hard using data to drive our decisions, and we are maintaining that individual focus and class size under 30. So I appreciate your feeling for the program, team is on it, but I don't want anyone to have the general impression that all of a sudden our average class size has gone from 20 to 40, because that's not true.
I would say there, and we had this conversation yesterday, actually, Bob and I were talking, and there are pockets, and Evelyn said that. There are pockets that we are paying attention to that we're going to have to make some investments in for that exact reason. You're right. I mean, but that's our job, right? Our job is to identify those as we go along and to move resources strategically to the areas that are growing like that where we have to take care of them.
Yeah,
but this is where the budget model really works. Okay, so when you think about what existed in 2016, Business College was not growing then. It was pretty static. But if it had been, like our College of Health and Human Services, all of a sudden, you would feel the pressure around enrollment, but the dollars wouldn't necessarily flow because of that enrollment. What you have now, Potter College is now the smallest college on our campus, right? College of Business is the fastest growing college on our campus. And so what you see are resources flowing to the fastest growing college. And so that's on the deans to take a look at the class size, to work hand in glove with the provost to adjust and to relieve that pressure, right? So Shane, absolutely you're feeling it. That's a good thing because you have a dean who's paying attention, additional resources coming for it. The same thing happens in a college that's declining. So there are resource constraints that get created with declining enrollment that you feel in other places. And so again, dollars following students and course taking patterns, decision-making decentralized to the college level, I actually think it's a really good thing. And Sam, to your credit, I'm not saying you're not feeling it. You absolutely are. And so we got to get that kind of back into kilter, well, but across the institution.
Remember, there's a little lag, too, right? As things grow, there's a lag to get to it at that point. It's not immediate at that. And that's why it takes us a little bit of time, because we work on budgets in yearly sessions. And that changing that takes a little bit of work, especially, as you said, Shane, in a little tighter budget, right, where there's not lots of money where I can just say, okay, go for it. I mean, there has to be done in a strategic model, and that's what we're working with.
So, Mr. President, to go back to one thing, we're all fans of the RAMP model.
Yeah.
We're all supportive of the RAMP model. We truly believe in it. But when we did our budget cut this last year, you know, went to academic affairs, it was an across-the-board budget cut. And I've heard from multiple deans about that. It did not flow in a strategic way. It wasn't across the board. And that was the budget realignment strategy. So I think that may be why we're seeing even more pressure. We didn't follow the principles of RAMP as we did that. So,
and I will remind folks, we didn't do that for a pretty specific reason. Somebody help me remember what that was.
We were told that we wouldn't pass the budget if we didn't have those numbers.
And so we wanted, and the deans wanted, for that to follow the RAMP process. We didn't have that figured out by the time the budget was here, and we were told as leadership that there would be opposition to passing that budget. Shane, you were part of that conversation. And so we did it across the board because we needed the budget passed. Just a reminder that it was you and Regent Brinkley who made that request.
I would say, but what we've done now, I mean, in all the stuff we've done since then, it has been done in a way. I mean, TAAs, and now what will be returned will be
ASIP over the last year was done in proportion of who lost people, because it has to be done, right? If you lost 11 people, we can't give you $2 and give somebody else a bunch or even it out, because places like Ogden, who in the both VSIPs have taken a pretty big hit, have to get the people back to be able to do what you want to do, Sam, which is have small classes, right? And not have a class of 400 sitting in Ogden, but a class of 30 sitting in Ogden. It takes a biology class at that time.
And so, I think going forward, Shane, to your point, they should, any reduction, if there is one, should be allocated according to the RAMP model. I completely agree with that. We were in a place where we needed the budget passed, otherwise we would have had a whole other set of issues, right? And so I appreciate the point, but I just want to remind folks that how we got there.
I would add, too, though, that as we are able to hire faculty, I'm going to brag on this university and particularly on my college. We just finished an economics search for an assistant professor that had 400 applicants. And we landed and just finished the hiring for a young man from Michigan State who could have literally gone to any university in this country. And he chose to come to Western. And so sometimes when we're on the inside of an organization, it is very hard to see how we have it as compared to those we're competing with. And the fact that 400 individuals wanted a shot at a position at WKU speaks very highly of what we're doing here.
I think this conversation has been good, and I think it's a great example of how AI doesn't bring content. The decision making.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with wanting it all, Sam.
No. Yes.
I hope you can feel that way all your life. We can always get it all. Any other comments, discussions? We're going to put this in the bed.
I'll take a motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second by Regent Kurtz. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. And action item AA2 is passed.
Great. AA3 is the approval of an undergrad certificate in business law offered through the College of Gordon, through Gordon Ford College of Business. Oh no, Evelyn's back.
You know, he says that to me every time I walk in his office. this one, actually, I'm excited about both of these programs, but this one I am particularly excited about. This is a collaboration with Fire College, particularly political science and sociology. So one of the things that started the conversation around this one is we're getting an increasing number of business students who are choosing to go on to law school. We have some very successful examples. One is an attorney for the U.S. Army and is stationed in Fort Knox currently. Many of them are part of very successful practices in the region and in the area. And so we started a conversation around what if we gave them some additional training, additional credentials, additional opportunity within our college and our university to help those finance majors or accounting majors or HR who aspire to law school, first of all. Secondly, every discipline in the college touches on the legal aspects in their discipline, but this allows those students also to really dig deeper. So, as an example, my daughter's an HR generalist at Mac. She's dealing with law and legal issues every single day. So to the extent that we can graduate students who enter as entry-level employees and have a really great understanding of the law, we're now reducing the risk for the companies who hire them because they're going to get great employees. This will also be a popular certificate, I think, for students across the university. Our pre-law majors, others across Potter and other areas of the university. But this one was done collaboratively, as I mentioned, across the colleges, but led by the three full-time faculty in our college who are also attorneys. They led that discussion, led that charge, and I'm really proud of the outcome.
Comments, questions, discussion? Hey, come on.
I got my licks in on free check.
Very good. If there are no questions or comments, I'll entertain the motion.
So moved.
Second.
Second to approve action item AA3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign, motion passes.
And again, I'd like to say, you notice the interdisciplinary of all of this, yeah, and the ability for students across the whole campus to be able to take advantage of all these different types of programs. And that's huge as we move forward. Next one is approval of sabbatical leave for faculty. You have a list of faculty. Please remember that they were recommended by for sabbatical leave by their department, the chair or director, the college sabbatical advisory committee, the dean, and by myself. So it's gone through a process to be able to be even thought about. They have to put a nomination in, and the university, and they have to put in what I would call an application as well as a compelling reason of why they need a sabbatical and what they will do on that. So everybody gets a chance to read that, and everybody gets a chance to think about whether that what they did is important for their career as they move forward. As they say, professional academic enrichment for their career. And what we have today is 9 faculty from 3 colleges that have been recommended for sabbatical.
Comments about sabbaticals, Shane?
As always, when we get to this point, I just thank the university for continuing to commit to faculty development. It's a great benefit. It also leads to this academic renewal to allow people sometimes to redevelop themselves in America. It's one of the better benefits that we have.
It's not a vacation.
No. No, and I would say that the group that has just come back and has, you have to put in, of course, then to tell us what you've done, have been amazing. With some of the stuff they've done. They've been around the world. They have done huge numbers of papers, all kinds of scholarly activities, changed their whole area of scholarship. As Shane said, it's just amazing to read.
All right. Any other comments, questions? If not, we'll entertain a motion for approval of the recommended sabbatical.
Motion.
Have a motion.
A second.
Campbell, second. Bridget Nichols. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign, motion passes.
AA5 is one of my favorites of the year, which is approval of University Distinguished Professor appointments. And the appointments are for Dr. Ru Zhang who's a professor in chemistry, and Dr. Anthony Harkins, who's a professor in history. And again, just to remind you, it's a review of nominations, and it's done by the UDP Professional Selection Committee. They look at and make a recommendation to myself, and then I make a recommendation to the president, who then says yes or no. I can have a few minutes. I'd love to tell you about the 2 people.
I think that would be appropriate.
Dr. Zhang has brought distinction to the university through his teaching, research, and public service, and is an exemplary faculty member in the chemistry department in the Ogden College of Science and Engineering. His research in the development of novel methods for oxidation transformation has earned him international recognition in his field. This is demonstrated by research productivity of 31 publications, and probably even the best part of it, with 29 different students at WKU. His external funding has been over $2.1 million, and he's had over 100 students work in his lab to get research experience. In addition, in the classroom, Dr. Zhang always takes a personal touch with his students, ensuring that they learn not only chemistry, but professional skills, emotional maturity, and independence. He is the kind of professor whose door is always open for students and colleagues, and he participates actively in departmental decisions and decision-making. And I think he's the perfect person to be a university distinguished professor. And he's here today.
It's such a great honor and also a pleasure to be here with all of you. And also thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to express my profound gratitude and appreciation for this great honor. Now, I'm particularly actually grateful to this university that gave me the privilege and also support over almost two decades. Allow me to teach actually a student in classroom and work with them in the research lab. And more importantly, together we serve the community in a variety of ways. I always think the biggest reward for my job is my student success. I want to thank actually my former and current students. I always actually told them, yeah, your success is to make my job meaningful. And also, yeah, it's actually, this is definitely is a milestone for my career. That will make me actually stay more humble and more grateful and in my daily job. So thank you very much. And allow me actually here to say a few words. And after this, I have to leave because I have a class and I need to catch back, yeah.
Thank you for obviously bringing the human touch to your classroom, too. Yeah, and Melissa, you can back me up on this, but I remember, it's been a long time now, when I started medical school, and we had classmates from Harvard and Yale and all over, and it was apparent real quickly that, dang on, the students from Western, you know, they were really good. And it was because of these things that Shane was talking about, and which we talked, they had had a lot of personal touch from professors that those of us that had gone to big R1 universities didn't have. And I think it's professors like yourself who obviously gave that personal attention that it does make a difference, a big difference. So thank you for being here, and congratulations on a well-deserved award.
Thank you.
That's
a big deal.
The second person is Dr. Anthony Harkins. He served WKU with distinction and excellence. He is an engaging and compassionate teacher whose teaching style helps students think critically about culture and cultural intersections in a variety of ways. His extensive research commitment has enriched the WKU experience, created cultural engagement opportunities for the wider community, and engaged young people in the discipline of history. Dr. Harkins has long served on the Cultural Enhancement Series Committee, and through his role has created meaningful opportunities for people in the region to experience interactions with artists, thinkers, and performers. Flowing from his own experience as a Fulbright scholar, he also works to make the experience accessible to WKU other WKU faculty as the WKU Faculty Fulbright Liaison. He's also a scholar. Dr. Harkins is an Appalachian Studies scholar who has made a national impact in the field, which has brought distinction to the History Department and WKU. His long-standing interest in pop culture, images of Appalachia, recently culminated in the production of an award-winning book, The Appalachian Reckoning, in 2019, a book responding critically to J.D. Vance's best-selling memoirs, Hillbillyology, and his simplistic and problematic portrayal of poverty in Appalachian culture. Dr. Harkin's commitment to excellence in scholarship, teaching, and service certainly makes him the perfect person to be a university distinguished professor. And he's not here today. He is out of town, but he sent me an email this morning. He said, I am deeply honored to have been selected as the UDP committee and the provost as a new member of WKU's University Distinguished Professor faculty. Please accept my sincere apologies for not being able to join you today. I am on sabbatical this semester and unfortunately have previously planned travel outside of Bowling Green, and I would be happy to attend a future Board of Regents meeting and have a chance to meet with all of you in the future. If I am confirmed, I look forward to serving on the UDP committee to advance the university's mission and to build connections between WKU and the broader community. Now, more than ever, we must make clear WKU's importance not only as the economic engine, but also as the vital educational and cultural hub fostering civic engagement, and making a tangible positive impact on the region and the globe.
Wow.
So I will invite him into a future meeting so you get a chance to meet him.
Yeah. Make sure that happens.
It will.
All right. I'll entertain approval for two distinguished professors.
I'll make a motion.
Second. Motion by Regent Nichols. Second by Shane. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, like sign. Very good. Those are all our action items. We have some information items.
I do. Just a couple. We're reopening the RN to BSN program, and Dean Basta is here just for a quick tell you what we're doing.
Okay, so this one's a little bit different. I know you've heard about a lot of new innovative programs today. Ours is actually reopening or bringing back a program that was sunsetted back before I got here. So our RN to BSN program is exactly that. If you have an associate's in nursing or an ASN degree, it's an entirely online degree in 1 year where you earn your bachelor's of science in nursing. The reason why it was sunsetted was reallocation of resources. And there are lots of RN to BSN programs online that students can do. And so they felt like that was a better use of our resources at the time. However, since I've been here for the past 6 years, all I hear is, can you bring your RN to BSN program back? Because the WKU program is so much better than some of the others. And so we decided with a new change in leadership, it was time to bring this program back. And so we were hoping to have 20 to start in the fall, moving it upwards, probably up to around 50-ish, maybe more. But that would require some additional resources. So we're hoping to fill with 20. I have no doubt we'll fill 20 like this. Owensboro Health and TJ Sampson Med Center all would like to do direct billing for their ASN RNs that they currently have so they can earn their BSN. So I have no doubt that it's going to fill very quickly, and we will probably have to move that past 20 very soon. So that is why we're bringing it back. Hanover did a study and gave us the budgeting credit hour number we needed to be competitive in the market, and so that has been approved, and so we are here to move it forward. Any questions?
Questions?
I'm sorry, tell me what BSN stands for.
It's the Bachelor of Science in Nursing. It's our 4-year nursing degree.
Thank you.
Yes. There also was a shift about almost a decade ago that places were not going to be hiring associate degree nurses. They really prefer a BSN. We can talk about how that market has ebbed and flowed.
Sure. So for accreditation for hospitals, they really were pushing to have a higher percentage of BSN prepared nurses than the ASN prepared nurses. So just so you all know, they both are registered nurses, and so they get the same job. They're essentially 2-year or 4-year degree are prepared to do the same job. It's just the BSN has a higher level of education, right? And so there were hospitals requiring a higher percentage of BSN prepared nurses, and then they backed off of that, especially with COVID, as we backed off of everything related to healthcare. But the hospitals are wanting to get back there because a BSN prepared nurse has a higher level of education, can do a lot of times moves into a master's degree, can move into administration, some go on for a doctorate. So it also helps then, I should say, to we broke our chain of LPN, the ASN that we have currently at WKU. You can earn that entirely online minus their clinicals. Then they can go straight on for the RN to BSN, and then they can go on for a master's and a DMP. So we kind of broke the chain a few years ago, so now we're also bringing that back. So it's to meet student demand, but also for our healthcare organizations and SCI, who also have been asking repeatedly for us to bring the program back.
So you said something interesting there to me is the competitive landscape. So there's a mixture of online and face-to-face, the clinical courses, face-to-face, and all these things.
This one's entirely online, though. Yes. There's no clinical because they already have their RN degree, so it's earning a lot of their gen ed requirements and some of the other requirements to be associated with the BSN degree. But what we did, and I didn't share, is that we did make this at least innovative and new in the curriculum to keep up with Louisville and what they've done, so you can earn up to 18 credit hours for practice experience. So if you've earned credentials in nursing, which is fairly standard, they will count towards or up to 18 credit hours coming in towards the 60-hour degree. So it is new and improved.
It's just one of those things that scares me on the advertising I see on TV when they say, I'm a nurse, and I took my test when I wanted to.
Entirely online, yeah.
Like, I don't want you as a nurse.
So I think what's important here is that they're already nurses, and they're already out practicing.
Right.
And most of the time, it's their hospitals paying for them to earn the additional credential.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much, Dean Boss.
Thank you.
And the next item is a very important one.
I would not be doing my job if I didn't remind you of SACS as we come down the homes at this point. Oh, we're going to go to the slides. I didn't know if we were going to the slides or not. I'm going to leave the slides. I don't think you need, you have a copy of them in your thing. I'm going to say two things. I'm going to say where we are, where we're headed, and what QEP is at this point. So where we've been is we're in the reaffirmation, of course, the 10-year reaffirmation of SACS, COC, and that is certainly underway. We submitted our compliance certificate report in September, which was reviewed by an off-site group and SACS review, and we got it back in November. The off-site committee gave us some feedback in some areas, and since then we have responded to their feedback and supplied them with what, in some cases, they wanted, which is as little as, could you put this in a table so it's easier to read? And sure. And we've done that. And what we've also done is finished the QEP, which you saw up there a minute ago, which has caused TAPA rise, and I'll talk about that in a second. That has gone in, and we have hired a person from the faculty to be the new director of the QEP, which is Dr. Wren Mills. So that's where we are. So what's left? Well, the fun part is left. They will be here March 11th through the 14th. They will have meetings over a three-day period, and as they walk out the door, we'll talk to the president and I about what they're happy with, what they're not happy with, and we will get to know all of that. But they will meet with everybody on campus. They will meet with faculty, students, administrators, and the BOR. Not all, but a set group. We just got, 3 days ago, kind of what they're looking for, and they have asked for 3 BOR members. And I will be tapping some people here soon so that you know what's coming. And not only that, you know what the date is, and we can tell you times so we can see if you're free and make sure you're there. So that's what we're working on right now, is getting the schedule together. They will be on campus. They can interview you, and if they need more BOR members, if I call you on the phone, I would ask you to be willing to get on a Zoom. They can ask for anything at any time. So they kind of have control for the week as we hang out with them. So if they can say we need more faculty members and we have to go find them immediately, so that's where we are. Lots of it will be about the QEP and talking about the QEP, and the other parts will be about what they asked us to look at and make comments on and changes about. And I think we're ready. I think the comments we got back were minimal. As the person running this, which is Beth Labas, has done an incredible job and made it a lot less painful than it's been on most campuses, because she's been ahead of the game in all cases. And her last line to me today was, I fully expect WKU to be on the reaffirmation list. She sees it as we have done what we have needed to do to be able to continue on as an institution. So QEP. So QEP is called Topper Rise. It came out of what would be business and industry as well as careers. When we go out, the thing I constantly hear out there, and so does everybody else, and we've done some other things out of the College of Business and other areas, is our students are the hardest working students that they actually hire. They're also well prepared with a knowledge set and skill set, but where they struggle at times has to do with some people call them soft skills. We don't like to call them soft skills anymore, but they struggle with certain areas like that. And what you've seen in the state is the state has seen the same thing and have heard the same thing from the businesses that are moving in. So the state created what something called the graduate profile, which had 10, what they think are 10 important areas that if we can teach our students these extra areas, that are already being done in classes, and they know what they are, will allow them to have a better chance at a career or finding their first job and moving out there. And I wanted to give you a list of what they thought were those 10 things. And we're working with the state, too, to do this. So when I get to it, I get my hand to work today. Bad hand. The 10 are effective communication is one that, another one is critical thinking and creativity. Another one is adaptability and leadership, collaboration, as well as informed decision making. There's 10 of them. Those are just 5 of the 10. The idea is we do teach this, and it's taught throughout all classes, and it's especially taught in the Gen Ed. But we haven't done a good enough job, and our QEP is about helping faculty identify what they do in their classrooms of these and telling us how they do that, as well as telling the students and being, I guess, direct with the students about how we're teaching them these parts. So that when a student gets out, they understand that you wrote this and you did it in the way we did it so that you could learn how to communicate in writing and speech and those types of things. So we have a whole plan. I didn't give you it. If you would like it, I'd gladly send it to you. It was only 98 pages. And welcome to our world at this point. But it spells out the whole process by which we will start from square zero to getting it into the Colonnade and having it the students understand what they're learning, as well as the faculty being direct with the students on how these assignments help them learn. And it has to do with all kinds of things that go on between point A and point B. And I think it's a great move. The state has a high priority in this, and we were on top of it as it started in the state, and we've been able to roll it into the QEP, and I think it will only help our students to be able to do what they want to do in the future, which I hope is to find a successful career.
Could you go over those first 5 things again?
Yeah, I can give you them all. I mean, effective communication, critical thinking and creativity, quantitative reasoning, and it's in the...
They're in the
summary, too. Cultural competency and that kind of stuff. You can see what... And they're defined, and we've worked with the state to create rubrics to be able to measure them, and we are in the process. Part of this is that once we have done this intentionally within the Colonnade and you know what you should get in the class, by the time you get done or get near the end of the Colonnade, it's about how do we get you ready in career services to be successful. And that career services plays a huge role in this too.
Thank you. I found it. I just missed it before.
No, that's fine. But that's where we are. That will be part of their evaluation of us and whether our assessments work and how they think we can change it in that type of sense. It's a 5-year plan, so it goes over 5 years.
And while these 10 things cover a lot of things, it makes me think of the book we talked about, Knowledge Towns. And it is a lot of what we have strived to do is being part of the community and meeting the needs of the community and preparing students for competency and lots of different things. But that book, I think, is a nice prep for whatever discussions may occur with the folks that come in.
I should tell you that, you know, this was vetted across the university. There were choices, like 10 choices of what we wanted the QEP to be. There was surveys sent out. There were about what was the originally what you would like to have. We have a committee of, I think, 35 people who have worked on this. It's been owned by the university, and this is the direction we've gone in. So I think we do this really well on this campus. I just don't think we do it intentionally. How's that? To tell people what they get. I think our students, I was incredibly excited and rewarded the other day. I went to, and I go to most of them, I go to career fairs on campus because that gives me an opportunity to see students at what I hope is their best, mm-hmm. and them showing what they've learned, why they've been here. So I was at the business career fair looking for a job first and then looking at the students. People always ask, are you looking for a job? No, I don't think so.
And it is year four.
It is year four, I know. And we were talking, and I was impressed by the way they were dressed, the fact that I looked at resumes they had, which were amazing. I looked at the communication, the eye contact, all kinds of things that I think are all part and parcel of what we're looking at here as we move forward. And that make, as Sam said, make this place special. And that makes me excited, right? That's this excitement for me. And I see it across this whole campus when I go to those, right? And that's the reason now when we hold them, from when I first came, there were maybe 20 people there, 20 groups there. Now there's 100 groups, all wanting as many students as they can from here. So that's a huge change for us as we've been moving forward.
We haven't talked today about the Center for Innovation and stuff, but so much is going on out there, and you see it in the paper a lot now. Some aspect, somebody's coming in, and that's a real great thing for our university to be doing for this region. And our Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning, too, we don't talk about that enough, but whatever.
Which is amazing.
That's a long enough academic committee.
Sorry.
Thank you.